James Boswell's Life of Dr. Johnson. There were perhaps no two people of the 18th century who seemed to be less likely to form a close and enduring friendship than Dr. Johnson and James Boswell. They were divided by age. Johnson was 53 when they met and Boswell 22. Johnson was a struggling author, Boswell in line to inherit an estate and a title. They were different nationalities. Boswell Scottish and Johnson a die-hard Englishman to the core. And he never let Boswell forget the difference between Scotland, an impoverished country, and an economically vibrant England, and teased Boswell mercilessly. Mr. Ogilvy was unlucky enough to choose for the topic of his conversation the praises of his native country. He began with saying that there was a very rich land round Edinburgh. Goldsmith, who had studied physic there, contradicted this very untruly with a sneering laugh. Disconcerted a little by this, Mr. Ogilvy then took new ground, where, I suppose, he thought himself perfectly safe, for he observed that Scotland had a great many noble, wild prospects. Johnson.
I believe, sir, you have a great many. Norway, too, has noble, wild prospects, and Lapland is remarkable for prodigious noble, wild prospects. But, sir, let me tell you, the noblest prospect which a Scotchman ever sees is the high road that leads him to England.
This unexpected and pointed sally produced a roar of applause. After all, however, those who admire the rude grandeur of nature cannot deny it to Caledonia. Johnson was deeply religious, to the point of superstition, and was terrified by the prospect of death, whilst Boswell did his duty as a gentleman of position and attended church regularly, though he struggled with his beliefs, and his morals were questionable, to say the least. Boswell married in 1769, and was a loving husband and father, though not faithful, and the lure of London life was always there. Both Boswell and Johnson shared the affliction of melancholy, which gave them a mutual empathy, and as they grew to know each other further, their differences became insignificant in the light of their mutual respect for each other, and ultimately, love. He mentioned to me now, for the first time, that he had been distressed by melancholy, and for that reason had been obliged to fly from study and meditation to the dissipating variety of life. Against melancholy, he recommended constant occupation of mind, a great deal of exercise, moderation in eating and drinking, and especially to shun drinking at night. He said melancholy people were apt to fly to intemperance for relief, but that it sunk them much deeper in misery. He observed that labouring men who work hard and live sparingly are seldom or never troubled with low spirits. When they were separated, they both felt a sense of emptiness, of something missing. Johnson despaired if he didn't get letters regularly when Boswell was in Scotland, and Boswell, too, complained of neglect when the doctor was too busy to put pen to paper, something he hated doing unless he had something to say. They sparked off each other, not always agreeing, but feeling that their lives were the richer in each other's company. My revered friend walked down with me to the beach, where we embraced and parted with tenderness, and engaged to correspond by letters. I said, "I hope, sir, you will not forget me in my absence." Johnson.
"Nay, sir, it is more likely you should forget me than that I should forget you."
As the vessel put out to sea, I kept my eyes upon him for a considerable time, while he remained rolling his majestic frame in his usual manner. At last I perceived him walk back into the town, and he disappeared. Johnson was Boswell's greatest friend, and changed his life and outlook through their conversations and by his religious example. So when the doctor died in 1784, Boswell felt an overwhelming desire to write his friend's biography, never having attempted anything of this nature before. It was undoubtedly a massive labour of love, and although he was aware that it was a presumptuous task, as he admits in his opening paragraph, he says he is determined that the end result will be a true portrait of his friend as he really was, displaying alike his virtues and his faults. "Everything relevant to so great a man is worth observing," he said. It took a long time to materialize. Boswell was not the most organized or diligent of men, and the prospect of a drinking session or an enticing Covent Garden whore would postpone the writing and, later, the daunting task of editing the colossal amount of material he had accumulated. Boswell had sent out appeals to Johnson's friends for letters and memories, which proved to be legion. He was lucky to have the assistance of the Irish scholar Edmund Malone, later to be a great Shakespearean scholar. He was diligent and organized, and pushed Boswell onward through his project when he flagged. But he found his collaboration frustrating. Boswell was also in competition with eminent men like Sir John Hawkins, who was the executor of Johnson's estate, and felt it his duty to publish a life of the great man. Then ensued a battle of words between the two, with Boswell disparaging Hawkins's hastily produced biography as being inaccurate and at times giving a distorted picture of the doctor. Before he produced his definitive life, Johnson's old friend Mrs. Thrale had produced a book of recollections of Johnson, who had been her husband's close friend, and he had spent many hours at their house in the country. Boswell found Mrs. Thrale's memories faulty. He had been present at some of the incidents recalled, and at times vindictive towards the memory of a man with whom she had appeared to have had a warm and happy relationship. Such inaccurate reflections, rushed into print after Johnson's death, strengthened Boswell's resolve to produce a definitive and minutely accurate representation of his friend. The end result is one of the greatest biographies ever written in the English language. The first to give an honest, warts-and-all study of a complex and contradictory man, difficult to understand at times, as Boswell freely admits, not always right in his judgments, and often argumentative, simply to provoke debate among the circle of intimate friends who met regularly for convivial, often heated, but always stimulating conversation. Boswell's approach was innovative. Most biographies were uncritical eulogies, not psychological studies. His presentation was original, too. At times it reads like a play, with multivarious voices, each identified by names, just like a play script. Such a method brings the conversations to life, showing the idiosyncrasies of Johnson and his friends, Reynolds, Burke, Goldsmith, etc. Boswell jotted down notes during the actual conversations, and then wrote them up afterwards, relying on his remarkable memory. "We talked of drinking wine." Johnson:
"I require wine only when I am alone. I have then often wished for it, and often taken it."
Spottiswood:
"But by way of a companion, sir?"
Johnson:
"To get rid of myself, to send myself away. Wine gives great pleasure, and every pleasure is of itself a good. It is a good unless counterbalanced by evil. A man may have a strong reason not to drink wine, and that may be greater than the pleasure. Wine makes a man better pleased with himself. I do not say that it makes him more pleasing to others. Sometimes it does. But the danger is that while a man grows better pleased with himself, he may be growing less pleasing to others. Wine gives a man nothing. It neither gives him knowledge nor wit. It only animates a man and enables him to bring out what a dread of the company has repressed. It only puts in motion what has been locked up in frost. But this may be good, or it may be bad."
Spottiswood:
"So, sir, wine is a key which opens a box, but this box may be either full or empty."
Johnson:
"Nay, sir, conversation is the key. Wine is a picklock which forces open the box and injures it. A man should cultivate his mind so as to have that confidence and readiness without wine, which wine gives.
James Boswell was born in 1740. His father was the Laird of Affleck, and in time Boswell would also inherit the vast estate, which was a curse to him, as it led him into debt, and the running of which interrupted his jaunts to London and precious time with Johnson. His father was a strict Calvinist and a judge, an awesome, not a warm, father. Boswell loyally followed his father's profession of the law, but never made a success of it, which meant money was always wanted to keep up the estate his father bequeathed him. These conflicts in his life, strict Calvinism, the drive to succeed as a lawyer like his father, and his natural inclination for pleasure, produced his periodical bouts of deep depression. To escape his father's oppression and satisfy his cravings for the high life, he announced he was going to train for the English bar, English and Scottish law being different. So he arrived in London in 1762, and at once began to enjoy the high life. He thought he had a talent for verse, and so worked at getting an interview with the rising literary star, Dr. Samuel Johnson. Neither he nor Johnson probably realised the huge impact their casual meeting in Tom Davis's bookshop would have on the rest of their lives.
At last, on Monday the 16th of May, when I was sitting in Mr. Davis's back parlour after having drunk tea with him and Mrs. Davis, Johnson unexpectedly came into the shop, and Mr. Davis, having perceived him through the glass door of the room in which we were sitting, advancing towards us, he announced his awful approach to me, somewhat in the manner of an actor in the part of Horatio when he addresses Hamlet on the appearance of his father's ghost. "Look, my lord, it comes." I found that I had a very perfect idea of Johnson's figure from the portrait of him painted by Sir Joshua Reynolds soon after he had published his dictionary, in the attitude of sitting in his easy chair in deep meditation, which was the first picture his friend did for him, which Sir Joshua has very kindly presented to me, and from which an engraving has been made for this work. Mr. Davis mentioned my name, and respectfully introduced me to him. I was much agitated, and recollecting his prejudice against the Scotch, of which I had heard much, I said to Davis, "Don't tell where I come from." "From Scotland," cried Davis roguishly. "Mr. Johnson," said I do indeed come from Scotland, but I cannot help it. I am willing to flatter myself that I meant this as light pleasantry to soothe and conciliate him, and not as any humiliating abasement at the expense of my country. But, however that might be, this speech was somewhat unlucky, for with that quickness of wit for which he was so remarkable, he seized the expression "come from Scotland," which I used in the sense of being of that country, and as if I had said that I had come away from it or left it, retorted,
"That, sir, I find, is what a very great many of your countrymen cannot help."
This stroke stunned me a good deal, and when we had sat down I felt myself not a little embarrassed and apprehensive of what might come next. He then addressed himself to Davis.
"What do you think of Garrick? He has refused me an order for the play for Miss Williams, because he knows the house will be full, and that an order would be worth 3 shillings.
Eager to take any opening to get into conversation with him, I ventured to say, "Oh, sir, I cannot think Mr. Garrick would grudge such a trifle to you."
"Sir," said he, with a stern look, "I have known David Garrick longer than you have done, and I know no right you have to talk to me on the subject."
Perhaps I deserved this check, for it was rather presumptuous in me, an entire stranger, to express any doubt of the justice of his animadversion upon his old acquaintance and pupil. I now felt myself much mortified, and began to think that the hope which I had long indulged of obtaining his acquaintance was blasted. And in truth, had not my ardour been uncommonly strong, and my resolution uncommonly persevering, so rough a reception might have deterred me for ever from making any further attempts.
For Boswell, Johnson became the father figure he longed for. For Johnson, Boswell represented youth and ambition,
I love the young dogs of this age. They have more wit and humour and knowledge of life than we had.
Dr. Johnson was born in Lichfield in 1709 and went to Pembroke College, Oxford. But lack of funds forced him to leave early and earn a living as a teacher. Famously, he and his young friend David Garrick, also of Lichfield, walked to London to seek their fortunes. There, Johnson made a meagre living writing for a number of journals, until he made his mark with his poem, London. After 9 years' study, he produced his Dictionary of the English Language in 1755, which secured his reputation as England's most distinguished man of letters. He was a large and robust man, but eccentric and unpredictable. He had another particularity of which none of his friends ever ventured to ask an explanation. It appeared to me some superstitious habit which he contracted early, and from which he had never called upon his reason to disentangle him. This was his anxious care to go out or in at a door or passage by a certain number of steps from a certain point, or at least so as that either his right or left foot, I am not certain which, should constantly make the first actual movement when he came close to the door or passage. Thus I conjecture, for I have upon innumerable occasions observed him suddenly stop, and then seem to count his steps with a deep earnestness, and when he had neglected or gone wrong in this sort of magical movement, I have seen him go back again, put himself in a proper posture to begin the ceremony, and having gone through it, break from his abstraction, walk briskly on, and join his companion. A strange instance of something of this nature even when on horseback happened when he was in the Isle of Skye. Sir Joshua Reynolds has observed him to go a good way about rather than cross a particular alley in Leicester Fields, but this Sir Joshua imputed to his having had some disagreeable recollection associated with it. Johnson married a widow, Elizabeth Jarvis. She was 20 years older than he was, and though he loved her dearly, calling her by the pet name of Tetty, and mourned her deeply after her death, they seemed to live largely independent lives when settled in London. In 1762 he received a pension from George III for his services to literature. He was a committed Christian and a Tory, with traditional views on the hierarchy of class and the role of women, though he was always impressed by intellectual women who pursued academic careers. It was Boswell who challenged his prejudices, particularly against the Scots, and persuaded him to visit the Hebrides in 1773 and see his countrymen at first hand. Boswell and Johnson exchanged views frankly, laughed a great deal, debated issues, and became fast, if unlikely, friends, until Johnson's death parted them. Boswell's Life of Dr. Johnson is above all a testament to a great friendship.